Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I am your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Well, hello, Judy, and hello, viewers and listeners. Judy, tell folks, what is the title of today's episode?
It is How Surviving My Disastrous Relationships Helps Me Help Others, an interview with Emily Hart.
And I have to take the credit or the blame for that slightly convoluted title, but really it's a lovely interview we just did with Emily Hart.
Uh-huh.
She is a coach and she works with individuals and she works with couples and with groups. And she tells her story of how she learned a lot mm-hmm. from a series of relationships that didn't work. And it has a really happy ending. And you can check
does.
Out the interview to find out the super happy ending, which I just think is lovely. So, and she's a lovely person too,
yes,
and it was a lot of fun talking to her. Before we do that, mm-hmm. let's just put in a word for a few of our products
okay.
that we are discussing.
What should we plug first?
Whatever you think.
Okay, well, why don't we plug your books?
What a nice idea.
Talk about your latest book, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy Is Wrong.
Mm-hmm. That's available any place you can get books, and mm-hmm. also available as any of these books we're talking about are available as Kindle, as paperback, and also as audiobook as well,
right.
where for my books, I did the narration. Mm-hmm. And the book that started this whole
right.
podcast thing.
Okay, we have Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy, and How to Get It Back.
Yes. And I want to mention that I'm working on a book now, and I want to invite people to send me ideas, experiences. Mm-hmm. The working title of the book, this is subject to change, but the working title of the book is Betrayal, Faith, and Forgiveness.
Ah.
And, when I talk about betrayal, I'm certainly including a lot about infidelity, mm-hmm. sexual betrayal. And I just want to invite people, if you would like to send me your experiences, obviously I will disguise any personal details before mm-hmm. I would include anything, but I would love to include some of your ideas there and your
right. It could be from your own relationships or people you know.
Yeah.
You know, let's say you have a family member or best friend or a friend that went through something and you'd like to tell us about their relationship or mm-hmm. their disaster.
Yeah.
So
I invite you to please do that. Also, just mention one other book that you can get for free, a PDF
yes.
of the book. The one that Judy is going to hold up for those of you watching the video
right.
is available from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
It's called
7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life.
Yep. But I will say, you don't have to buy that one because if you sign up for Dr. Chalmers' newsletter, sign up for my newsletter. I put it out roughly once a month, and it's a lot of fun. And as soon as you sign up for it, you will get an email that has a link where you can download a PDF of that very book, 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life. Who doesn't want to have that, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So please do that. Let's now put in a word for our sponsor.
Yes, the sponsor is The Blue Tent, Erotic Tales from the Bible by Laria Zilber.
The Blue Tent by Laria Zilber. And Erotic Tales from the Bible, and it's really a wonderfully sexy book, as
mm-hmm.
the subtitle implies. And I will also mention we are doing a presentation that will include Judy reading from some of Laria's work.
Mm-hmm.
Judy actually did the audiobook version
yes,
of
did.
That, because Judy and Laria are like that.
Very tight.
And still haven't managed to get you and Laurie in the same room. It's really odd that way. But
well, if you come to the presentation.
If you come to the presentation, well, we'll be there.
Yes.
And we do have a video of Laurie.
Yes, we do.
She was able to do that. She just wasn't able to make the day work to be there at the
yeah.
same time as
well,
you.
Well, anyway, November 19th.
November 19th at Temple Sinai and in South Burlington, Vermont.
Yes.
Which is where we live.
We will be doing a presentation on Jewish perspectives of sex.
And in, February? I think we're doing one in Florida, which
right.
we will talk about in later episodes.
Yes.
We are scheduled to do one in Florida as well. Same presentation. Jewish perspectives on sex.
Mm-hmm.
So without further ado, let's get into our interview, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guest today is Emily Hart. Emily is a master life coach, NLP trainer,
hypnotherapist, kundalini yoga and meditation teacher, and Reiki healer. She offers one-to-one coaching, group coaching, certification trainings, and retreats. Emily co-founded the Heart School, an NLP certification and training program. The Heart School certifies students as NLP life coaches, NLP practitioners, hypnotherapists, and quantum time technique practitioners. Emily combines her passion for mindset work with her heart-centered approach to living and serving her clients and students. Emily, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Delighted to have you.
And full disclosure, I will say that I have met Emily. I actually know you through my daughter. So
that's right. Yes. We went to college together. We were college roommates.
Yes.
and you know, it's so neat when we do this and we interview all kinds of people. And it's fun when the wonderful guests we have are also acquaintances or friends or mm-hmm. people we've known before. That's really kind of a cool way.
In fact, we had a friend on who is also a Kundalini yoga instructor.
Oh, wow. Amazing.
How long ago?
Yeah. Eva Kane.
A couple months ago. Yeah. So we always like to start off by asking folks, like, how did you get into the work you do? Tell us about your own journey. What brought you into the kind of work you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the work that I do with clients now is really what I call self-relationship based. And how I got into that was through my own healing journey. And my personal struggles had come through the lens of romantic relationships. So essentially, I would date the same guy, different name. It would be the same pattern. The relationship would have a max 2-year shelf life. And the men would be emotionally unavailable, usually avoidant types. And I was more of an anxious type, if you're familiar with the attachment styles. Yeah. And they would end up in them leaving the relationship, them leaving and abandoning me and me feeling heartbroken. And so this continued to happen over and over and over from, you know, early, you know, college years up until my early 30s. I'm 37 now. So what finally happened as I went on in these relationships, they seemingly got a little bit better. The men, right? They seemingly they're improving a little bit, but still at the foundation, there was just this pattern that became very clear to me. And I did a lot of therapy, over a decade of therapy. And so I feel like I had like a PhD level knowledge in the origin of why I was attracting or choosing these types of men, right? It went back to my relationship with my dad and all of this. And even though I knew all of that, and I had done some work around it in therapy, I was still choosing the same people. Like my picker was still broken, right? Mm-hmm. I'm like, how is this happening? So the last relationship that I was in before my husband, I was engaged. And so I thought, yes, I've broken this pattern. And we bought a home together, and it was 3 months before our wedding. And, you know, it wasn't like all roses and butterflies the whole time. There were a little things coming up to the wedding, but I was still like, this is happening. Like, I love this man. And he came home one day, and I was standing in the kitchen, and he looked at me and he said, "It's over. I'm done." Like, I've decided this is not for me. I don't want to go through with this, and I'm leaving and I'm moving to LA.
Wow.
So yes, that's what I said.
Well, you did not see that coming, right?
I was blindsided because I really felt like for me, sort of my toxic trait in a relationship, I'm sure there were many. I was definitely not an angel. I think was that I would have done anything to save the relationship. Like, I was like such a fighter. Like, I was like, oh, but this is good. And this is good. And all we need to do is just fix this one thing. And if we could do that, right. So yeah. I was just diehard. And, I just didn't, I didn't really think that was a possibility. So I can even remember, like, he had known, like, some of my wounding. And, like, there was one point where he's just like, I'll never leave you. You know what I mean? And, like, those words to me felt really reassuring. And I believed them. So my life at that point just started to crumble because I was at the time in a job that I hated. Nothing in my life was really bringing me happiness other than, like, I really looked forward to this relationship and seeing this man when I would come home from work and all of that. So, like, it was a rock bottom moment, I feel like, in all areas of life, because I had bought this house and it was mainly me on it. So then now I had to figure out financially how I was going to continue with that. My career, I hated. And also my future, I thought that we were going to have children. We were about to get married. We had picked out the baby's rooms. And so everything was gone and like that taken away from me. I felt really lost. So this is what catapulted me onto my journey of healing. And I had a spiritual awakening after this, after a lot of grief and depression and couldn't eat for a while. And then finally I started to come out of it. And it was like a very clear choice. It was almost like a spiritual experience. One night I had this clear choice where it was like, you can let this take you down or you can rise up from this. Like you have a choice. I finally realized that I was the common denominator in all of these relationships. Finally, I'm learning the lesson. And I went and I did a lot of work around it. A lot of different healing modalities, like different places that I went to help myself. And then I eventually ended up finding NLP, which is now a big modality that I use with my own clients and of course my training company. And during that training, this is like flash forward to 2020. I had done a lot of work along the way. I hadn't dated anyone for probably about 2017 until 2020, I didn't really date anyone. I was really focused on myself and my own healing. And in 2020, I believe the last piece that I needed was going to this NLP training where I identified a belief about myself, which was, this had been unconscious. So if you know Carl Jung, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will rule your life and you will call it fate. I was unaware of this belief system that I found out in the training that I identified, which was anytime I let a man get to know the truth of who I am, they won't love me anymore and they'll leave me. So like a mirror. Yeah. So like a mirror, the universe was showing me this over and over and over until I was able to heal that within myself. I did that in that training. And that's when I started dating my now husband, literally inside the training. It was like that.
Wow.
So that's how I got here to what I do today. And it wasn't really planned, but I was very passionate when I was on the healing journey of helping others. I thought I might go back to school to become a therapist. And then I was just led down the path of I'd started Kundalini. I did Reiki. I got into the mindset work and the NLP. And then it just sort of organically unfolded from there. Mm-hmm.
So when you say NLP, I'm assuming you're talking about neuro-linguistic programming.
Yes.
Why don't you explain what that is for those of us who are not familiar with what NLP is? Because I know Bruce, being a therapist, knows all that stuff, but me and some of our listeners might not know that.
And I can learn too. So please.
Absolutely. Yeah. So NLP is a really large body of work. A way that I can break it, I'll break it down for you with each word. And also I like to explain in a couple different ways, depending on who I'm speaking to. You could call it a user manual for your brain. Mm-hmm. You could also call it the science behind the law of attraction. And most of the work that I do within it is really subconscious reprogramming, where we're able to go back onto the timeline of someone, into their past, could be generational, and get to the root cause of like a belief system or whatever it is. so that we can resolve it at the root cause, and then resolve it on all the other events that are coming all the way back to now that are triggering them. So if we break it down, neuro is how we perceive the world through our five senses, right? So visual, auditory, kinesthetic, which is feeling, smell and taste. So how we're perceiving our world through the five senses, because the reality is actually our perception of it. Linguistic is the words we use to influence ourselves and others. And this can be actually verbal, obviously, but also nonverbal communication. 93% of communication is nonverbal, which is pretty wild. When I learned that, I was like, wow. So we teach a lot of different things about body language and all of that. And then also self-talk. So the little voice that's inside of your head that can sometimes be the itty bitty shitty committee, or sometimes it's the empowering coach. So getting that to be in alignment. And then programming. So how we discover and utilize the programming that's running in the background, and how we can optimize that so that you can reach your goals and your intentions with less effort and more ease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with it's certainly NLP, I first learned of it back in the 70s, which is when it was, I think that's when it was first put together, right?
I believe that is.
Spacing out on the names of the, there were these two guys.
Richard Bandler and John Grinder.
Thank you. Bandler. Yes. Wow. It has been years since I read about them. But yeah, it was fascinating stuff.
They really modeled excellence in a lot of different people, like therapists, like Virginia Satir, and Milton Erickson, who's a hypnotherapist. So they saw excellence in other people and they modeled it and broke it down into a repeatable process. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it's such a big body of work, because there are all these techniques that when people come in, like a lot of times they'll like know, they'll already be like, oh, I feel like I do that. Like we teach, you know, how to build rapport, right? Like that's a part of what we teach in day one, which people are like, oh yeah. Like when you meet somebody, you start discussing commonalities. Oh my gosh. Yeah, Alex, we went to school together and like all of that, right?
Alex is Judy's daughter, by the way, for people who are listening.
Yeah, that's a part of building rapport. So anyway, that's just an example of how, they didn't necessarily invent anything other than timeline therapy, which is the quantum time technique that it could be interchangeable. Those words, timeline therapy and quantum time technique. Tad James, who was one of Bandler and Grinder's students, came up, innovated that and came up with timeline therapy, which is a really
that one I had not heard of. So that's more recent than I've read about it, obviously.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. You also do hypnotherapy. I'm also trained in hypnosis. Well, I've been focusing on couples now for years, so I haven't been doing hypnosis. But how do you use hypnotherapy in your work?
Yeah. So when I do timeline therapy with clients, we take them into a light trance. So I feel like I'm always kind of using it when I'm working in specific techniques with them. And I also really enjoy doing hypnotherapy at the end of our work together. So say I work with a client for like 3 months. What I like to do is sometimes I'll do it in the middle at some points, but I'll always do it at the end. And the reason why is because I like to lock everything in at the unconscious level. And so I'll do a hypnosis for them at the end, I'll record it, and then I will, give it to them and say, hey, listen to this every night for 30 nights, you know, before you go to bed.
Yeah. No, that's neat. That notion of locking in is fascinating. You know, one of the reasons I got trained in hypnosis fairly late in my career, actually, mm-hmm. I was already in, I think I was like 60 when I finally got.
Yeah,
I'm 72 now. So, you know, it was about however many years ago, 11 years ago. But it was interesting because I found it so powerful. You know, it's funny when the first training we did, they did it just to demonstrate it. And we were all obviously willing subjects because we were there trying to learn hypnosis. And they did just a arm. Whoop, you can see that on the video here, the arm levitation technique.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me because I remember at the time thinking, You know, and as I say, I was very willing, but I had never actually been formally hypnotized, you know, gone through a formal hypnosis thing. And I remember thinking, and quite, you know, wide awake, and I remember thinking, I wonder if this is going to happen. And then there it went. And it's funny, I can do that now. I can, all I have to do is summon up the thought now. And, you know, my, if those of you watching the video, my hand is going up and my perception.
Later.
Yeah, believe it or not, my perception is it's going up by itself. Now I have control over it. I can make of it course. Go. But that was so fascinating, such, you know, the trance ratification, they call it, you know, demonstrating the idea that this unconscious stuff is really quite powerful. And in fact, it's most of what's going on in our mental life. The vast majority of what's going on, although I have no idea how to hang a percentage on that.
It's 95%.
Well, I don't know how you measure that, says the old, I'm yeah, also a statistician. I have no idea how you measure that. But it's a lot. The point is, most of what's going on is not conscious. There's only little bits of our experience that are conscious. And so to use hypnosis when somebody has had the insights and the understandings you want them to have is really helpful, because if they want to, of course, because it has to be voluntary, if they want to, their unconscious will get on board with that. And then it becomes their new guiding narrative. Mm-hmm. You know, they're no longer bound by those old understandings. Do I have that right?
More absolutely. Or less? Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I think just like a lot of it too, which I'm sure when you went through the training is sort of debunking like what hypnosis is and what it's not, right? Because when people think about hypnosis, they tend to think of like somebody with a watch that's going, right?
Yes.
Or which a stage show or something.
The funny thing is that can work. You know, there are a lot, we learned that's a number, I'm sure you did too. There are a number of ways of inducing a trance that works. It's just so hackneyed. Nobody wants to do it. Right. You know, I mean, it works. It can work if somebody wants it to. Anything can work.
Bruce has tried to hypnotize me. It didn't work.
Well, I think that it's about our relationship as anything else. You know, I'm coming from a different place when I'm with you. So, I don't know.
I always say too. Yeah, because sometimes when you're in partnership with somebody, it's like you don't want them to be your client because you're almost like too close. I feel that with my husband.
Well, I would never attempt anything therapeutic. But it was in terms of just helping you sleep or something. Right. It's like, no, that wasn't, you were having none of it for me. You haven't tried it with someone else.
That's true.
So it actually could work well for you. It's hard to say. It doesn't, you know, people vary in their hypnotic talent. I'm middling myself, you know, in terms of my own hypnosis. I'm not somebody that I would want to have, for example, abdominal surgery with no other anesthesia. I've met folks, and I'm not trained in doing that either. But I remember some folks that I worked with when I was doing hypnosis that were astonishingly talented at it. Mm-hmm. I remember one person before we'd done anything formal, and I was just explaining to her about what it was, and she was already off in a trance. It was amazing.
Wow.
She just had incredible talent. A lot of folks who have histories of abuse, especially as children, get very good at hypnosis because they learn to dissociate very early. And so there's some research on that I remember being told about along the way.
Yeah, so, I always say like it's a critical, like there's like a critical wedge between the conscious and the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so the people, when we do some suggestibility tests, which I'm sure you've done, right? In our training or teaching it, like the book and the balloon, having the heavy books in one hand and the balloon. So you see, you can see the arms. It's interesting to see like, because the student's eyes will be closed, whose arms are like that, you know, close, and then whose arms are like this, because, you know, whoever is really like this is more suggestible, which from my perspective, it means that they have less of like a critical wedge. And the people that have the thick critical wedge are usually the people that identify as like, I'm a realist, right? I'm a realist. They're very like skeptical of everything.
Well, and it's interesting because I think, I don't know that I would define it as suggestibility per se, and more about situational suggestibility. You know, if you're into it, and it, you know, if you're clearly into it, that's going to make it much more possible. If you're skeptical about it, or if you believe about yourself, for example, that no, you're just not susceptible to that, then you're not going to be.
Yeah,
right.
You actually have to be open. Yeah. If you had any reason to and actually explored it, you might discover actually you can be quite good at it. You'd actually have to sign on.
Yeah.
You know, we unconsciously sign on. You say, okay, this, I really want to do this. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, then it works. And what I always enjoyed about hypnosis was that idea that it is entirely voluntary, even if you're not conscious of it. And yes. So to the extent that, you know, I remember one of the things in one of my trainings I did actually when I was a student being trained, and the trainer was inducing a trance and used an image that I just hated. He was talking about, you know, your eyes are heavy, got no problem with that. In fact, it's hard to open them. I got no problem with that. In fact, they're sewn shut. As soon as he said that, I opened my eyes because I hated that. Now, there were other folks in the class. I think there were like 10 of us in the class, and two or three of us didn't like it. And the rest of everybody else was fine, you know, so cool. What was neat about it was I opened my eyes and said, well, you know, basically I said, well, screw that. I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to go into a trance anyway. I'm just not going to use that metaphor.
Yeah, that would freak me out.
Yeah, well, I just replaced the metaphor. I just said, no, my eyes are heavy, but they're not sewn shut. Yeah, I'm not going there. And it was fine.
Your techniques.
Well, no, and if it were, they'd be fine. And I told the trainer afterward, and he didn't realize that anybody would find that bothersome. And but that didn't mean he was wrong to use it. Well, that's my point of the story is it was kind of neat that I could reject that part of it still accept the rest of it. And I learned some techniques in that particular session that I used a lot when I was doing it.
Yeah.
So it's fine. You can pick and choose, you know, and your unconscious is going to do that.
Yeah.
And you can rely on that basically.
So now you mentioned that you had a career before this that you didn't like. Can you share with us what you were doing?
Yeah, I was doing tech recruiting.
Okay. So nothing related at all to what you're doing now.
No, I've had like many careers. When I was living in New York, I was doing retail management and merchandising. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to Austin, I started a whole new thing in tech recruiting. And now I'm doing what I'm doing now. So yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about the Heart School.
Yeah. So the Heart School is a breakthrough and training company. And we certify people in NLP. So some people come in and they're like, I don't care about the certification. I just want to get a breakthrough at the unconscious level, right? Like I want to break through this thing in my life. Right. And so some people don't care. Some people do, they want to become coaches or use it in some way. But yeah, it's a breakthrough and certification training. So it's NLP practitioner, NLP life coach, timeline therapy certification, and hypnotherapy. And we have this is level one. We also have a level two. And we do this totally immersive in person. It's really cool to see everyone go through it. Everyone gets a chance on every single exercise to be both the client and the practitioner. And we actually take a photo. I always think this is such a great part of it. We don't advertise this, but I joke that it also comes with a free facelift because we'll take a photo of people before we start on day one. And then in the same spot after we end on day five, and we put those photos together and it's like night and day, like people look different. Like their cheekbones seem to be higher. Like, just their faces looked at the color of their face. So it's really interesting. It's one of my favorite things that I do. Yeah. It's a great training.
So, you know, this, of course, our podcast is all about couples work, especially. Mm-hmm. And so tell us about, you know, how do you apply these ideas in health? And I realize, I don't know if you work with couples or work with individuals who are, most of whom are in some sort of relationship probably, or trying to be. How do you apply those ideas to help people with relationships?
Yeah. So in terms of like what I can talk about one-on-one and couples, in terms of one-on-one, you know, we focus just solely on romantic relationships. A lot of times it's somebody that is looking to attract their partner. And so we get to sort of the root of what's in the way of that. Cause that was my journey. I was realizing that I was the common denominator and I was the one who was, you know, sort of attracting these types of men, right? Whether I like to admit it or not. So, so we work on that, and we do a lot of, subconscious reprogramming, inner child work, all of that, to help them get to where they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of couples, I like to always start by, eliciting like their values in the context of relationships. Because from my perspective, a lot of times in relationships with others, if there's conflict, it could usually be a values level conflict.
Yeah.
And values are actually unconscious usually, unless the person has done values work before.
Mm-hmm.
So the master level training for NLP teaches us, and I train people in this as well, on how to elicit people's values, hierarchy them, and then also change them. And so with couples, we're able to elicit them, and that can be an eye-opening experience in itself. Mm-hmm. And then there can be some negotiation, right? If one person, you know, has like fun as one of their top values and the other part of the couple is like, you know, doesn't have that there. Okay, well, how can we negotiate this, right? We both want the same thing, right? We want to have a better, healthier relationship or whatever it is that they want. And so we're able to make some negotiations. So I love that part of it. That's usually where I start with mm-hmm. couples.
It's interesting because that particular issue of difference of values, that's where some of the deal breakers are. You know, and they could be as simple, not in the case of easy, but as right. simple as, you know, I've worked with lots of couples over the years where they've been together for several years and then they have the conversation, oh, by the way, would you like to have children? And come to discover one does and the other doesn't, which is the classic deal breaker, unless somebody changes their mind or doesn't really care that much, which it's rarely they don't care that much about that particular one. That one can end up being a deal breaker.
That's a
big one. Because, you know, it's like logically you can't, as you well know, did we already point out this?
No, we didn't.
Oh, yes, we can mention this.
We can say this now. yes. So Emily is a mom-to-be. You just found out that you are going to have twins.
Yes. Yep. Coming May 2024. So this is my first pregnancy and we found out we're having twins. So we're very excited. We were also a little shocked.
About the twins part, not about
the pregnancy. Yes, about the twins part.
I take it that your husband was on board with the idea of having children, right? Or at least having a child.
Oh, yeah. My husband is a kindergarten teacher.
So oh, wow.
He is like, he's one of those men, and I don't know if this is common or uncommon, but he's one of those men that has like always wanted children, like since he was, you know. So sometimes I think for men, it takes them maybe a little bit longer uh-huh. to figure out that they want kids, but he's been one of those people that's just always wanted them. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And loves working with them. I mean, obviously, to be a kindergarten teacher.
You
wow.
certainly have to love that.
That's patience, impressive.
Patience is one of his number one qualities.
that's a good one.
Yeah.
No, that's neat. So, you know, sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's interesting. I was just, sometimes, I don't know if you call this values or not. I've just was talking with a couple yesterday where it's almost like they speak a different language. And I'm not talking about the sort of classic love language thing. I'm talking about this is one where this couple in general is doing quite well. I've been working with them for a while. They really are doing quite well. The one remaining thing that really gets to them is that when it's a heterosexual couple, when she wants to just vent, she wants to say, oh, I had a rough day at work. And he doesn't know how to help her at that moment. He wants to solve the problem. She does not want the problem solved. That's classic,
yeah.
right?
That's classic, yes.
But we got, that's what we want to do.
Women do it too. It's not
women
just
do
guys.
It too. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
That's me. I just want to solve everybody.
Well, it's why you're not a therapist, actually. Because no. therapist, if we do that, it doesn't work. But yeah. But it was interesting because what came up yesterday and this is a couple I work with for like a year and a half now. What came up yesterday was really interesting where she was saying, they were telling this one anecdote of where this had occurred like the day before or something. And she was talking about how I'm just trying to tell him, you know, this was difficult. And he was saying, you were crying. She was saying, I wasn't crying. I mean, yes, I was teary. And he was saying, well, obviously he was saying to me, she was upset. And I realized, you know, it's interesting. She didn't say she was upset. She said she was venting. You see it as upset. And, you know, come to find out in their respective histories, in his family, their gamut of emotions ran from A to B. You know, they did not show that stuff. It was like he had just brothers and his mom was by both of them describing a very nice person who brooked no nonsense. Mm. It's like, you're not going to complain to this person, even though she's very nice. They said nice things about her. And there was that idea that he was seeing her being in distress when she was trying to say, I'm just venting. This is what I sound like. And yeah. She had a history from her own childhood of stuffing her emotions. She wasn't allowed to say stuff. And she's been working now in her early 40s, I guess now, mm-hmm. on being able to say what she wants to say and not have mm-hmm. that be a disaster. But he clams up because he feels like whenever he says anything, it seems like she gets pissed off at him. That's what their difficulty is. And you could, I don't know if you'd call it a values difference, but it's almost like it's a different set of assumptions they're working with. And they didn't realize it, which is always to me to render those assumptions we're making visible so that you can say, oh, look at that. Isn't that interesting? You're Absolutely. Making different assumptions about what that behavior represents.
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's all well-intentioned because I had the same thing with my husband. And because he likes to fix things as well. And so I find that it's just like some of my responsibility in it is saying, hey, I just want to vent right now. Like, I'm actually not looking for any feedback. I'm just looking for you to like hold this space.
Right.
And sometimes I will forget and like, I'll just be in it because I'm more of an emotional person. And my husband's very like this, like he's super like even keeled. So we're very different. And sometimes I'll start going into it and he'll be like, okay, hold on, pause. Do you want feedback or do you just want to, you know, get this out? And I'm like, oh, thank you for asking that. And then I'll tell him. Yeah.
You know what I'll often tell the guy in that situation, because being a guy myself, you know, heterosexual male myself, that, you know, if we're seeing our woman, to be kind of use that sort of language, in distress, you know, our damsel in distress, that part of the masculine thing, which I think is not the toxic part, you know, mm-hmm. part of the good part is, I want to protect you. I want to make you feel better, of course.
Sure.
I often note to the guy is, you know, there is a problem to be fixed, but you're fixing the wrong one. It's not what she's telling you about her problem at work, which, let's face it, if I start telling you how to fix your problems at work, I'm implicitly saying you're an idiot.
Right.
Because I'm mansplaining, right?
Right.
Should I explain to you two women what mansplaining is? Right. Right. That's a classic, isn't it? So that, you know, I don't want to do that. But there is this is to the guy, because we got to have a problem to fix. The problem to fix is what she's looking for is empathy. She just wants to know you love her and care about her and respect her. And she just needs you to show that in whatever way, which could be as simple as giving her a hug or offering a cup of tea or just sitting there listening and really trying to take it in. Any of those are fine.
Or a foot massage.
Hey, that works. Right. Foot massage. Always good. Well, actually, not everybody, right?
But that's true.
Different strokes for different folks, literally. But that idea that there, you know, because men, we don't necessarily know how to understand it. If, you know, when a woman says, I just want to vent, and I'm, you know, you'll get the deer in the headlights look on the guy because it's like,
yeah,
blah, 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 what am I supposed to do now? You
know? Just shut up and listen.
Yeah, just shut up. But that's the thing. You say that, but that isn't really enough. You know what I mean? It's not just shut up, because sometimes the guy will do that.
Yeah.
He'll just sit there thinking, oh no, I better not say anything, which is the opposite of actually being there.
Right.
So it's like, no, just listen.
Just listen.
And then it almost doesn't matter what you say or don't say.
Yeah.
You just show up and don't panic. Yeah. And of course
I find too, like it's even like and I think it's so different for like every woman, like, or every person, like what they are needing. And so I think it's like the two people in the partnership are like learning, you know, they're always learning. And for me, what I've learned is like, it's the way he listens. So it's like, I need him to be listening with his five senses. Mm-hmm. And I know that might sound a little, but that's truly what I need. So like, he's able to now know that. And so it works better, but yeah.
Yeah. It's that ability to show up and not, you know, that's the thing about if he goes into a panic or if she does, either one, then you no longer have that ability. Much of your brain then shuts down.
Right.
You know, when you're in fight or flight mode or freeze mode and you don't have the ability to be there with your five senses.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, that's the thing I'm always preaching. And one of my shticks is that every couple needs both stability and intimacy. And the chief skill of intimacy is to tolerate anxiety. Mm. It's not to, you can't make it go away, because it'll be a little scary when you don't know what you're getting and it's a little scary to reveal yourself to someone who is really important to you. But to tolerate that anxiety is what facilitates intimacy, and that's a need.
Yeah. And I think willingness too, like I always say, like, just that's like the number one thing I love about my husband. Like, and it's such a characteristic that when women are looking for partnership, I feel like willingness is so important, right? It's like the willingness to do the work, the willingness to go to couples therapy if you want to or need to, like the willingness to say, okay, she said that she needs my five senses to listen right now. Like the willingness to do that, to sit there and show up like that. So right. Yeah.
Don't look at your phone.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yes. No, we don't like that.
Yeah. No, very few people like that.
No.
Yeah, indeed. Well, what else should we be asking you about?
Ooh, I don't know.
Is there anything that we haven't asked you yet that you want to bring up, or have we pretty much covered the bases?
I feel like we'd cover the bases. I would love to ask you guys about like I love to ask people who have been married for a long time in a good relationship, like, would you mind sharing like your top advice? And hopefully your listeners will like this too.
Thank you for the question.
Our thing is find the right person.
Yeah. I've written several books now on couple relationships and realize, and we've joked about this, I could have just written a four-word book, find the right person, you know?
Oh, those are the words, right? Okay, got it. Yeah.
Well, those are not the seven words. No, those are different. No, the seven words
are be kind, don't panic, and have faith.
And rather than go over that, I will refer our listeners to actually going back to episode one, where we explained that, and we've come up in various episodes. And our story, we just happened to look it up today for the benefit of somebody who was asking about it. We told our story in episode 42. This is episode, I think it's 137 or 138. Okay. So just, you got to go back a ways. It was back in 2021, I think. But I think
what Bruce said recently, just before, is being able to tolerate the anxiety, to have the intimacy. And I think my problem in past relationships, and as you know, I had a first marriage, it was trust. You know, not being able to trust the other person. And Bruce, I can trust.
Mm. And it's interesting, and I can trust you too.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that trust is built, it's actually, I'll tie it to what you said, Emily, a lot of the trust is built out of that notion of willingness. That, and, you know, which again would say, yeah, willingness to tolerate that anxiety. In other words, it must be a little scary for your husband, perhaps, you know, to hear from you, hey, I want you to listen with all five senses. And if you said that to me,
mm-hmm.
part of my first thought would be, oh shit, what does that mean? You know, I mean, I sort of get it, but now am I going to do it right? And I have to not panic about that and actually say, I'm going to try that, you know, and I'll rely on you. And what I trust you to do, interestingly, is not panic about my failures in that, but mm-hmm. rather enlighten me.
Right.
Enlighten me compassionately. And of course, what you have to trust me to do, or otherwise I've blown it, is listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are all the skills that you end up developing.
Mm-hmm.
And
another thing is, I know without a doubt that everything Bruce says and does, he always has my best interests at heart.
Yes.
So I know I can rely on that rock solid piece of knowledge, and then I have his best interests at heart too.
So important.
So that really is what makes for a trusting and loving relationship.
I want to add to that though. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because of course that's true,
mm-hmm.
but I want to add to that because but I'm not going to be perfect at that.
No.
And nor are you. But then that's an important part of it. In other words, we have to be strong enough individually.
Yeah.
And see, that's another thing about getting into a relationship. When we met, I was already in my early 50s. You were in your mid 40s. And so we were both mature. We had been through, you know, previous marriages. And that phenomenon of being able to be strong enough as individuals
mm-hmm.
that you can then manage the little bits of being out of sync without panicking. is also central to building that trust.
Yeah.
Because you can trust that I always have your best interest at heart. You can't trust that I'm always going to get it right.
No. Well, you know what I mean? Not everybody's going to get everything right. I'm not going to get it right.
No, exactly. But, yeah.
And, you know, we don't always agree on everything either.
Yeah.
But I still know that whatever you do, you have my best interest at heart.
Well, it's that underlying sense that whether we agree or not is secondary to the fact that we know we love each other, which I think is really...
Yeah, you know, you don't let the little stupid things bother you. Like, you know, if there's a wet towel on the floor and like, I know some people freak out. It's like, oh, he left the towel on the floor again for the 100th time. It's like, so bend down and pick it up, you know?
Yeah.
Or leave it there and eventually he's going to pick it up. You know, if it bothers you that much, pick up a towel. You know, I'm going to drop things. He's going to drop things. And it's like, you know, pick he doesn't notice that. Things that he drops. And most of the time I don't say anything.
That's right. Another endearing characteristic, by the way, most of the time she doesn't say anything. So, and you know, all of that, you know, when you, like, of course I do meet couples where they're fighting over everything.
Yeah.
And what seemingly, and they'll say that too. They'll say, oh, we fight about seemingly trivia, you know, it's usually because they're fighting about something else. Mm. And it's too scary to fight about the thing that's really scaring them. So they fight about the towels on the floor and everything else. Or, and sometimes, you know, the power struggle stuff or the stuff about who's doing more, you know, sometimes that's a reflection of genuine exhaustion.
Yeah.
Especially, not to say this to you when you're pregnant with twins, but you may discover, some discover that the early phases of infancy, especially with twins, is rather tiring.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of energy. I'm glad you're young, you know, I mean, relative to the likes of us, you know, it's a good thing. But that, you know, that stress level can be difficult. It's also an interesting phenomenon that, you know, when you have kids, it does a number on a relationship early on in terms of you don't have time and energy for each other the way you do before you had kids. And that's something that for a couple to thrive, even when they have kids, they need to pay some attention to that.
Right. And make time and space for each other.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Good stuff. Yeah. I liked how you said find the right person. And I wanted to just say one thing off of what you were mentioning, because how, Judy, you said that you could trust Bruce in this relationship. And I feel like that is so big, but it doesn't come with every relationship. And it's so interesting to think of like what that is. And like, what I have found is it is about the right person, right? Because like, for instance, with Jack, like I talk about this, online and because a lot of times I work with people, and I used to be this way too, who are looking in dating, when they're looking for their person, they're looking for fireworks and butterflies and all these sparks, right? And it's like all of those for me ended badly, and I didn't actually feel that same thing with my husband,
right?
I felt calm, and I actually thought in the beginning, I remember having a conversation with my mom, calling her and saying, this relationship is boring. And then I realized that it was actually stability. And I had never felt that. I was used to the up and down roller coaster. So I think, like the trust, I have that trust for him too. And it's like a big part of that is, I don't know if it was there like right at first, but it was like this, you know, a slow sort of build where like his actions kept matching up with his words. Like, this is interesting.
Well, and that, you know, in a relationship where you've, that's why I talk about stability and intimacy. Stability is every bit as important. And when you don't, it's very difficult to sustain intimacy. I mean, that's sort of what lack of stability means. You can't sustain it. And yet you also need to have that sense of intimacy, which is where the spark is. And that is something that can be built over time. Also mention one other thing in terms of trust, which is I work with lots of couples where there has been flat out infidelity.
And
many of them split up. I mean, that's not that surprising. But many of them don't. And the ones that don't, the ones that survive that, their relationship is like a new relationship. It's better than it ever was.
Wow.
It's the only way they survive it. And that's how they can rebuild trust. they can sort of, they can recognize that it's very difficult. It's spiritual work. You mentioned, you know, a spiritual awakening. That sort of thing is spiritual work. It's a lot about that sense of accepting yourself and each other as fundamentally valid, even when you've screwed up royally. Then it's possible for trust to take over there. Difficult, very difficult. I never recommend that as a way to improve someone's relationship. Yeah. Oh, go have an affair. That'll help. Yeah. No, set things up. It probably won't help. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you. This was, yeah, it's my pleasure. This is really fun. Really enjoyed this.
Tell folks how they can get in touch with you if they are interested in what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I hang out on Instagram, which is at Emily Hart. That's my last name, H-A-R-T, coaching. My website is emilyhartcoaching.com. And my email is emily@emilyhartcoaching.com.
And we will put that information in the notes for this episode.
And do you also do online coaching, or does it have to be in person?
Yeah. So I do all virtual stuff with one-on-one, and I'm also doing a group program for women right now who are either struggling in the current relationship or wanting to attract their partner. So it's a group setting with women. And then I also do one-on-one with both men and women.
And those are virtual? Know that they can do it from any place.
Yeah. All virtual. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's neat. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for having me. This is awesome. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that interview.
It was a relationship
with Emily. Yes, it was. Yes. She's just delightful.
Yeah.
And, I love how she just turned her life around. She mentioned, you know, her fiance leaving her, and we mentioned that my daughter and Emily were roommates, and she actually flew to what was supposed to be Emily's bachelorette party, mm-hmm. and it was, I think they called it "I dodged the bullet."
Yeah.
Party.
And then she went without dating for several years,
yes.
which is always a smart thing to do.
Yes, and did a lot of work on herself. Yep. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage to do that.
She found a Mr. Right, clearly.
She did, a lovely, wonderful man. So we're very happy for Emily and Jack.
And she's pregnant, now pregnant with twins, which is really cool. So it's always nice to have a happy ending like mm-hmm. that. We'll just mention briefly our books and stuff. Go to our website, ctn7.com. You'll see that floating above my head as I say that, and you will get information on all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm guessing those of you who are watching through to the end here already have the information you need to know. Just a reminder of our upcoming presentation on November 19th at Temple Sinai in South Burlington, Vermont. If you want more information about that, you will find that on our website as well.
And also, if you would like to be a guest on our show, mm-hmm. we would love to have you. You can sign up at ctn7.com and tell us what it is that you do and how you think that you would be a good fit for our show on couples therapy.
And lots of people have done that. And mm-hmm. it's been pretty much the case that when they've said that, they're right.
They were
great guests. And that's how we get a lot of our guests. Mm-hmm. And so until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.